The Victorian era, the Victorian age, can claim to have given the modern world all sorts of goodies. Photographs, radio, telegraph, the bicycle, x-rays, postage stamps. And they also had a passion for setting standards. The railways needed timetables, so the clocks were brought into line, and Greenwich Mean Time was adopted. Threads and screws of all different sizes hampered manufacturing. Thus, the Whitford standard became the norm. So rules and codes for sport were introduced. But what about dogs? They too, according to my next guest, became standardised, designed, manufactured, modernised. Michael Warboys is Emeritus Professor, Centre for the History of Science, Technology and Medicine at the University of Manchester, and Michael's co-author of The Invention of the Modern Dog, Breed and Blood in Victorian Britain. And he joins us now from Sheffield. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Okay, thank you. It's very nice to be here.
I've been interrogating my other guests tonight on whether or not they had dogs. You don't actually have one, do you? But you got a keen interest in the species because of your study of rabies.
Yes, I published a book nearly over 10 years ago now on the history of rabies. And when we were doing that, we tried to set it in the context of what was going on in Britain at the time. And we were shocked to find that in the nation of dog lovers, nobody had written the history of the dog. So we set about doing it. And the invention of the modern dog was the result. And the big finding was that breeds as we know them are only 150 years old.
There were any number of types of dogs around, of course, for millennia, but they weren't standardised.
No, there were when the first lists of dogs were drawn up, say in around 1800, there were only kind of 27 of them, and they said things like retrievers. Any dog can be a retriever, and we kind of know that. If you know any dog, if you throw a ball, we'll go and collect it, and the types of dog that existed had been bred to do particular tasks, that either to collect game that had been shot or to protect sheep from wolves. And so, I mean, something like a sheepdog. I mean, we now think about sheepdogs as dogs that round up sheep. But at that time, you wanted a big dog, possibly a mastiff, that would frighten away wolves. So what dogs did counted for more than how they looked. And it was only when the Victorians started to develop competitive dog shows that they developed the standards that produced the kind of dogs that we know today.
Of course, prior to the Victorian age, there had been quite a lot of work in breeding cattle, hadn't there?
Yes, the really big development was actually in the breeding of sheep. A British farmer called Robert Bakewell, developed a new breed of sheep called the New Leicester, which he claimed had particularly good properties for meat and for wool. And the particular feature of the New Leicester was that it bred true. That is, it had pure blood. So you couldn't just kind of get those features from any sheep. You actually had to get them from Bakewell's New Leicester. And so in Bakewell's hands, breeds became specialised, standardised, but they also became brands. And what happened subsequently was that other people developed different breeds, and they were all brands. And possibly the most successful sheep breed of all time is actually the Merino, because that has travelled all over the world. But recent genetic studies have revealed that it's the least inbred of any breeds. The latest research says that Merino sheep breeding is really quite safe because there is such genetic diversity, that there's been so much crossbreeding and changes over time that the Merino genome is actually very, very varied, and so it doesn't suffer from the inbreeding problems that you actually get with cattle and with dogs. And so Merino is, you have to, you know, the best way to think about Merino is as a brand rather than a pure breed.
I'm a farmer, and we've had to destock entirely because of the an unprecedented drought. But we've still got one herd of sheep, Shropshires, dear little things. But we also, of course, when you're breeding cattle, you go for hybrid vigour. Was that something that the Victorians wanted to do with dogs?
Only up to a point, only when the pure breeds started to show degeneracy. And that degeneracy showed in weakness of physique, inability to reproduce. And in those cases, they would, what they called outcross, they would go to another breed to introduce new blood. But their goal was to keep the bloodline as pure as possible. And so they weren't particularly worried about inbreeding because they thought they could go out and get back to the original type in three or four generations.
There's some echo, of course, of what was going on in the Victorian aristocracy, the human aristocracy, who had to bring in those wealthy young brides from the United States to stop inbreeding.
Of course, and if you look at Victorian dog books, they have the pedigrees of dogs laid out in the same way that pedigrees of aristocratic families laid out. And of course, but the I don't know, it's the same thing. But one of the things about dog pedigrees was that it depended an awful lot on trust as to whether the particular dog named as the father or the mother was really the true dog, and one of the features of the Victorian dog fancy was kind of social class, and who could you trust? And the argument was that you could trust a gentleman, but you couldn't trust a dog dealer, or you couldn't trust a working class dog owner, because they would be interested in profit rather than having true blood or pure blood.
So the idea of the dog show kicks in during the Victorian era?
Yeah, there's really... The word dog shows in the early Victorian era, but they took place in pubs, and they were working class, pubs and bars, and they were working class events. What had happened in Britain is in the 1830s, dog fighting had been outlawed, and dog fighting, it wasn't so much the fighting, it was the ability to bet on the result that made them attractive. And so they found other sports, in inverted commas, to bet on, and the two favoured ones were ratting, where you would have an enclosure and you'd put in 50 rats, you'd put in your dog, and then you'd time how long it took to kill the 50 rats, and the dogs would be put against each other in an evening, and people would bet. There was a shortage of rats in some cases, so they then moved on to beauty contests, and so there were beauty contests, and what they were looking for was not a standard type of dog, but a dog, a terrier, that looked the most aggressive or that had the most beautiful coat. They called them beauty contests. The other route was from agricultural shows, where they had developed shows for sheep, cattle, poultry in particular, and dog shows were added to those. And the really key figure in all this is actually a sporting administrator or a sporting journalist. There was a doctor called John Henry Walsh who ceased being a general practitioner when he shot half his hand off in a gun accident, and he became a journalist and author. And he published two lines of books. One was a series of books called British Rural Sports, which laid out the rules for all the sports that developed, not just rural sports, not just shooting and hunting, but also football, cricket, bowls, tennis, those kind of things.
Suddenly the Marquess of Queensbury comes to mind.
Yes. Boxing as well was part of this. Well, boxing was in the pubs, firstly, and then it moved to the more aristocratic, realm. But Walsh, through his books, British Rural Sports, and he also edited a weekly newspaper called The Field. More or less, he didn't do it himself, but his publications were the where these things were communicated to the public. And his influence is he organised the first Wimbledon Lawn Tennis Championship in 1877. If you wanted to enter that championship, you sent your cheque to Walsh at his home in southwest London. And, you know, he organised, first of all, it was a men-only thing, and then women were introduced, and his daughter did very well in some of the early contests. But he, alongside that, he published a whole series of books on dogs, and it was in his dog books that he set out the standards for modern dogs.
It's interesting, isn't it? The point I made in when introducing you was that the Victorians had a passion for standardisation, railway timetables, mm-hmm. Greenwich Mean Standard, the Whitford Standard for threads and screws.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so this was being extrapolated now to the dog. Was there an intense fashion in dogs? I mean, one thinks in recent years of the explosion in popularity of the Jack Russell. Did that mm-hmm. happen in Victorian times?
Oh yeah. I mean, one of the things typically of industrialisation that happens is that you get product differentiation. So in the very first edition of Walsh's book on the dog, there were 27 types of dog. By the time you get to 1900, I mean, he died in the 1880s, but the book continued to be published, there are 80 types of dog. So rather than being two types of terrier, a terrier and a Skye terrier, there are by then 10 or 12 terriers. And what drives these is competition at shows, but also fashion. And then increasingly, the British dog fancy import dogs from abroad. At the end of the century, there was a fashion for Russian Borzoi dogs. Ladies' lap dogs were fashionable at a particular time, and so there were the whole thing shifted from being based around agricultural shows to being large urban shows where celebrities turned up. They would have celebrity dog competitions. They would have, and even if your dog died, it could still enter a competition because they had competitions for taxidermied dogs.
Heaven's sake, dear oh dear. Okay, so, and there was attempts also to bring back lost or dogs that had been hunted to extinction, mm-hmm. like the Irish Wolfhound.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. The Irish Wolfhound, the standard view was the Irish Wolfhound had disappeared around 1720, and it was extinct because the wolf had disappeared from Ireland. There was an English ex-Indian Army officer called George Augustus Graham, who in the 1860s decided that he would revive the breed from extinction. So he travelled around Ireland, collected dogs that people said, although they didn't look like Irish Wolfhounds, they had Irish blood. He was obviously conned in many instances. He took them back to his estate in Gloucester, tried breeding for them, didn't work. They're mostly infertile. So he decided to start from scratch. And he got some Scottish deerhounds that were kind of like Irish wolfhounds, but smaller. And then he crossbred with other breeds. So he crossbred with a Great Dane to make them bigger. He crossbred with a Tibetan Mastiff to lengthen the coat on their things, and then they got a bit kind of Great Dane Mastiff-like. So he then crossed them with Borzois to make them more athletic type again. And so he then, over about 10 years, he produced an Irish Wolfhound to a template that he derived from books, from illustrations that he studied in the library. And he turned up with this in Dublin, and the Irish dog owners were up in arms. But it's quite fascinating today. If you walk around Dublin, the Irish Wolfhound is on all the buildings as the iconic national Irish dog. And the current one was invented by an Englishman from Scottish, Danish, Tibetan and Russian stock.
I think I've got half-remembered images in my mind of paintings in which these dogs are mm-hmm. painted with their proud owners. Of course, we had a whole school of paintings like Paulus Potter for cattle and, of course, mm-hmm. many a famous horse painter. Mm-hmm. But you're right, there's been very, very little attention given to the dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the ones that you see most often, and particularly paintings of Victoria, Queen Victoria and Albert, is with their King Charles Spaniels. But what they wanted was not a standard King Charles Spaniel. They wanted a unique pet. And the main thing they wanted was a loving dog that would put up with, you know, being carried around in a handbag and eating funny foods and all the rest of it. The last thing you want if you're an aristocrat is the same dog as everybody else. So it's only after the Victorians come in that you actually get the standard dog.
I've got to ask you this. Where did the royal obsession with the corgi begin? Were the corgis a Victorian invention?
No, the corgis came in the 1930s and 1940s. The fashionable royal dog in the 1930s was a dog called the Sealyham Terrier, that was a kind of a longer-coated version of the Jack Russell. And that was very popular with Hollywood celebrities. Sealyhams appear in various Hitchcock films. Hitchcock had a couple of Sealyhams, and lots of Hollywood stars at that time. And the royal family had Sealyhams in the 1930s, and then the Queen shifted to another Welsh dog, the Corgi, a bit later.
I suspect that modern DNA confirms your speculations or your researches on what was going on back then.
Absolutely. There's a group in Oxford, and they're pretty clear that most dogs, indeed across the world today, come from a gene pool that was created around 1850, 1860, 1870. They say that the idea of an ancient breed is absurd. I mean, A, there weren't breeds, and B, there was a kind of a narrowing of this gene pool around the 1860s, and it's spread out from there. So yeah, we were delighted that our historical research was actually confirmed by modern DNA work.
I think you really do have to get a dog, Michael. It's not good enough. You can't be a world authority on British dogs without having one.
Well, I'm afraid when I was a youngster, dogs never liked me. I think they could sense my fear of dogs. And there was one dog on our street that if my brother and I coming home from school saw this dog, we would go right round the block about half a mile to approach our house from the other end. And I think I've never recovered from this experience.
Well, you've made me wag my tail in this segment. So thank you very much, Michael. Michael Walvoys, okay. Emeritus Professor, Centre for the History of Science, Technology and Medicine at the University of Manchester, co-author of The Invention of the Modern Dog, Breed and Blood in Victorian Britain. Publication details on the LNL homepage.